What is up? Another episode of the Ripple Effect Podcast. Just want to give you a heads up on a couple things for any new listeners. The intro is called The Ripple Effect. It's a song by Theory 6, which is my music project. You can get a higher quality of Theory 6 music basically anywhere where you can get music, Amazon, iTunes, Shazam, all those places, Google Play. And also this podcast, because it's a little shorter than usual, like a dumbass, I end up talking to the guests before we start recording, not realizing I should be recording this. And then next thing you know, they only have so much time, free time, and especially with a busy person like Dan Carlin, who is our guest on this show, I end up recording and then trying to fit everything in I wanted to talk about while recording. So because the show is a little shorter than usual, I'm going to end up putting a sample of a song that I'm working on at the end of the podcast. It's a song that should be released hopefully in the next couple weeks. So make sure to subscribe to us and find our Facebook page, or just Google the Ripple Effect Podcast. You'll find it, and find Theory 6 Facebook page and my Twitter account, RV Theory 6. That way you can basically keep up with all the new stuff I release. And once it's released, you'll be the first to know. So definitely do that. Enjoy the show. I'm going to also put a song called Etria between the intro transitioning into the podcast. You'll hear a kind of a more metal influence song. That song is already released. You can find that anywhere where you can find music. And enjoy the show. Dan Carlin's a genius. We reference Daniele Bignelli briefly in the podcast. For people who don't know what we were talking about, Daniele Bignelli tweeted just before I think we went on the air something along the lines of nominating Dan Carlin to be the ruler of the universe, because if anybody can run things, it's him, because he's such a smart guy. And so we kind of laugh about that before the show, and then briefly talk about it or reference it during the show. So people who didn't know what we're talking about, that's what we were talking about. And I have to agree with them. I mean, I think people haven't changed that much. I think our surroundings have changed. I mean, we're, instead of horses, we're in cars, and we have phones and internet and all that stuff. But I think you look at really old quotes, not a lot has changed. That they still make sense today. Some of my favorite quotes are things, you know, from the 1800s or early 1900s, and you're like, wow, that makes just as much sense today as it did when he wrote it. So I think it, even though our surroundings have changed, I think people, a lot of our tendencies, a lot of things that cause issues politically or socially, socially, is that even a word? I don't know. I might have made that up. But I think those things are still there. I think those issues are still there, and what provokes those issues are still there. So somebody like Dan Carlin, who understands history, I think that's the best way of understanding what conflicts today and what causes issues today is understanding how history repeated and how we've dealt with the same issues in the past. And I think that's why his Common Sense podcast is so interesting to me, because to hear somebody talk about current events who understands the root of those issues and understands other times in history where the same issues that have occurred, I think it's super interesting. So I think I would have to agree with Daniele Bignelli. Dan Carlin's a real modest guy, so obviously he's not gonna agree with us. But enjoy the show. Before I make this this rant too long, enjoy the show. And like I said, subscribe to us everywhere you can find podcasts, and we put YouTube video versions of every episode on our channel, so subscribe to that too, and enjoy the show. What's up, everybody? Another episode of the Ripple Effect Podcast. We got an awesome show today. Real quick, just remember to go on Facebook, Twitter, and subscribe to us on our YouTube channel and all that stuff, just to keep updated with all our upcoming guests and all our shows and whatnot. But today I got a huge influence. One of the reasons why this podcast exists is because of just all these great shows that I listen to and I reference all the time on our show. And we have Dan Carlin, who does a show that, if you don't know what it is, it's a very popular podcast called Hardcore History. He just, his incredible storytelling ability definitely comes out in that show. And he also does another podcast, Common Sense, which I absolutely love too. And I know most people usually talk about the Hardcore History show, but I like the Common Sense show just as much, because I think that anytime somebody's talking about current events and politics with the understanding of history like his, I think that that's usually when you get the best perspectives. And I think most of us, to understand today, or to have a better understanding today, doing your research on history will make sense of a lot of the conflicts that go on today and how we got here and old conflicts of old countries and stuff. So definitely two really awesome podcasts. Definitely check those out. You won't regret it if you're a fan of history, and it's a perfect way, because I know most of us don't like to read anymore, so it's a good way of getting it audio wise. So I just want to thank Dan for being with us today.
Well, listen, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. And real quick, before we get into, I kind of wanted to get your opinion. I know you briefly talked about it on your last Common Sense podcast about poking the bear, and what do you think is going on in Ukraine? And what, I mean, I hear conflicting, you know, stories, and obviously the mainstream media is trying to sell you something. And you actually reference a really good Democracy Now! Video, which I saw too, and about, you know, basically that audio clip that they got and of talking about the U.S. and their hand is in this issue, and also in Venezuela. And so do you think that it is the Russia invading or getting involved too quickly when there was no need for it? Or do you think it really was something like I hear on the alternate media and like yourself on your podcast about the idea that they have a fear of NATO getting too far east? And obviously they have to protect their territories. I mean, Putin, even though he's a loony and he's definitely a little crazy, it's probably not a good idea to kind of step on his toes. And I think you made the reference, well, what would we think if he came to Mexico and started causing conflicts and funding revolutions and stuff like that? So do you think there is more than meets the eye? I mean, usually there is, but or do you think that the media is making a bigger deal out of it? I mean, what's your take on it?
Well, I don't think Putin's crazy at all. And I think you could make a case. A lot of people are screaming and yelling that he's made a big mistake here and that the Russian economic markets are going to pay a huge price for this and all kinds of things. But if you just look at the value of the territory that Russia took control of in the past week or 10 days, the Crimea, if you look at the value of that area, that'll pay off long term a lot better than whatever short-term troubles that Russia might suffer economically or through the markets or anything like that. So I don't think Putin's crazy. I think to be honest, I don't think it's something that the U.S. wouldn't have done either in a similar situation. I think that for a guy like Putin and Russia, they're looking at a territory that many of them rightly consider to be Russian, which many in the Western Ukrainian heartland in there disagree with intensely, obviously, but there's a lot of people who are more pro-Russia in the East. I think he just didn't want to have an unstable regime that seemed to be Western-oriented, not only right on his border, not only right in an area where a lot of Russian speakers and whatnot would be affected by it, but the Russians have their major military base, the home of the Black Sea Fleet, right there in Ukrainian territory, essentially with the Ukrainians as landlords. That's not a situation that any great power was likely to put up with for too long. To be honest, if you try to throw Putin's actions in sort of a template for state behavior throughout all history, seems to be pretty par for the course, if you ask me. I don't think it's dumb. I mean, fair, unfair, right, wrong, those are different questions, but not dumb.
Yeah, well, I guess when I called him crazy, I mean, I didn't mean so much that he wasn't intelligent with his strategizing. I meant more like he wasn't afraid to, you know, what some countries would say, you don't want to get on the wrong side of the U.S. I think obviously because of their nuclear capability. And I think it was funny because when I heard your Common Sense show, your latest show, Poking the Bear, I was glad to hear it because I've talked to some people about what's going on, and people just don't seem to really realize what this could cause. And I think who knows, maybe it won't turn out to be anything bigger, you know, like a nuclear crisis, but I think we have to look at it and say that the capability is there. I mean, the U.S. what Kerry said yesterday was insane. You know, what is he doing going into a country on false pretexts? And it's like one of my favorite quotes: the next war starts when people who remember the last war are gone. And it's one of those things where he thinks that people already forgot about Iraq and you know, Afghanistan and all our wars that were been kind of unjustified, and mostly because of, I guess, strategy for the country and for their own interests. And there was something in like 92, right, that Bush kind of had an agreement with Russia that they wouldn't, NATO wouldn't go to the to the West or East. I mean, Eastern Europe for the sake of kind of keeping, you know, I guess their territory, even though they had their independence, like countries like Ukraine and stuff, basically just to keep kind of make sure that nobody at any time could kind of invade them or whatnot. Wasn't there something like that? I think you briefly talked about it on Common Sense.
Yeah, the U.S., when the Soviet Union fell apart, successive U.S. presidents tried to soothe Russia's fears that we would take advantage of their weakness. And we told them we wouldn't move NATO right up to their borders. And then through a couple of different presidencies, we did just that. Ukraine is not part of NATO, but the Baltic countries are, for example. And if you look at a map, those border Russia. If you can only imagine, you know, if the situation were reversed and all of a sudden we had Warsaw Pact nations, which was NATO's opposite number, you know, in Central America, I don't think we'd stand for that very long. And your point is well taken about remembering the last war, but I want to take it a little farther because, you know, we have a lot of people in the national security apparatus of the United States who certainly remember the last several wars, but the last several wars were against powers that are no threat to us innately. You know, here's what I always try to tell people. Remember how old all these people in the national security apparatus are. I mean, I guess you could probably say that the top military official in the national security apparatus, he's a general, he's the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he's the guy who advises the president what to do in situations like this. He was a major when the Berlin Wall fell down or was knocked down. That's the top dog. You can only imagine who all of the people who form sort of the structure, the rank and file of our national security operations, the staffers, the mid-level people. These are people in their 30s. They are used to having a lot more tools to deal with a situation like this than they have here. I mean, normally, if somebody does something and the United States wants to react, we start talking about, okay, do we want to put boots on the ground? Do we want to send some cruise missiles towards them to send a message? There's all these things we can do. These people have no memory of contact with a nuclear power, somebody with thousands of thermonuclear weapons who can launch them at us in minutes. Now, you may say, well, no one would ever be stupid enough to do that, but it doesn't matter. If you're in the national security apparatus, you can't launch cruise missiles to send a message to the Russians. It changes the tools that you're accustomed to having available to deal with situations in a geostrategic sense. So these people don't really know what to do. They weren't around and in positions of leadership the last time they had to be careful with the way they, you know, dealt with a foreign power. In the last 20 or so years, we haven't had to be careful. All of a sudden, once again, we do. And you see what that means. That means in order for us to tell a person like Putin that they can't do something, you have to be ready to push the boundaries to World War III. And there's very few things most people would do that for. Certainly not a territory that was under Russian control for a very, very long time up until recent history.
Yeah, and I think what the media is not telling us either is that basically, like you talked about, half of Ukraine are Russian-speaking, and a lot of them, I mean, they're kind of separated in half where there is a lot of people in Ukraine that are basically, you know, they want to be a part of Russia or have closer ties to Russia, and then there's a part of Ukraine that wants to have closer ties to the EU, and you know, I think that that's kind of what caused the conflict initially. And but it definitely I think the thing that bothers me is that it's like the U.S. will flex their muscles, do these things like, you know, oh, Russia, you know, stay within your borders. Don't do this. Don't do that. And we do the same thing. And it's like most of the public here, I guess Syria was like the one case where it seemed like the public actually said, no, don't go into war. We don't want to get involved. And it actually worked. And it seemed like the politicians actually listened because so many people didn't want to go into Syria. They didn't understand the conflict. They weren't sure that the information they were getting was accurate. And they stayed, you know, they basically, I guess they listened to some extent, you know, and I think they realized that why has the civil war been going on for 3 years? And all of a sudden you went on a 1 month propaganda scheme of trying to sell us chemical weapons. So it's okay to kill people other ways, but now all of a sudden, so it's something seemed fishy. I don't know what the, why all of a sudden they wanted to go in there. But the one thing I love about listening to Common Sense, your podcast about current events and stuff, is that hearing somebody talk about current events who does have such a understanding of history and done so much research on it, it's amazing just your understanding of why these conflicts, just the roots of them and why they're there and why certain countries dislike each other and you know, and then you have a better understanding of. Do you think that's something like that is missing with, well, it obviously is missing with politics, but do you think that maybe that's something we should do? Maybe, I mean, obviously taking money out of politics would help, but I think with foreign policy, one thing that would be a huge help is, like Daniele Bignelli said, put somebody like you, king of the universe, and basically somebody who understands history so they can understand the history repeats. Like you said, the last 20 years we haven't had a lot of conflicts. We haven't had, so the Cuban Missile Crisis, all these other things seem like a long time ago, and we've had a pretty safe, I mean, we've been in wars, but I think because I do my podcast, I go to my job, I do this, I do that, it's a war, but we're not attached to the imagery, we're not attached to actual war, we don't see it on the news, so it almost seems like we're in a war, but we're kind of detached from it, so we kind of have this false sense of security and that nothing could happen. And do you think that maybe people understanding history and politics should be something that should be looked forward a lot more than it is?
Well, first of all, if my good friend Daniele said that I should be the king of the universe, that's a good sign that senility is setting in. And so he shouldn't be trusted at all to make a statement like that. The second thing is, you know, I look at it a little differently. Hunter Thompson, the great gonzo journalist, called it the new dumb. If you go back on YouTube and you search some of the old things that used to be on television, the highfalutin talk shows, you know, they're constantly made fun of, but they're smoking cigarettes, it's black and white, and they're having these really deep, hardcore intellectual debates over the problems of the day. And when you see those things, the thing that comes into your brain is you instantly realize that we don't have anything like that. I mean, we have 10,000 channels now. You would think there would be a spot for anything, and we have nothing like that. When I deal with television stations or production companies and we talk about doing this or that together, I'm amazed how scared they are of anything that even smacks of intelligence. I mean, if you had Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr., who conducted a famous debate with each other in those kinds of TV shows I was just talking about from the 60s, those guys couldn't get airtime today because the people that run the media outlets would assume that the listening audience wouldn't care and wouldn't understand the big long words they were using. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. They say that the general public is too stupid to understand these things, but by not exposing you to these things, you keep them that way if it's really true. So I think that the problem is if you actually are someone who wants to deal with nuance and deal with things intelligently and notice that not everything is black and white, and there's a lot of people out there that can do this, you're not particularly welcome in most of these news programs and analytical shows. I remember in talk radio being told that the main thing that my job was to do was to create heat. And you know what heat is? It's controversy, it's arguing, and it's all that. And anything that is too nuanced diffuses heat. And so the very things that you hope for in an intelligence conversation are the very things that work against what the people who run these outlets are trying to have. They want a conversation that devolves to arguing because they see that as something entertaining to watch. They've never quite understood that, you know, an intelligent, deep conversation about life all around us can be intrinsically interesting. And so I think that's part of what's missing. And that's what I hope that something like the new media can bring to the table. I'd love to think that it cuts out the middleman who encourages the new dumb and allows people to find stuff out there that challenges them on an intellectual level.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I think that domestic TV, you know, just cable TV it's dumbed down. But I think that a lot of the people who are looking for deeper things, people who listen to your podcast, people who listen to our podcast, people who listen to Rogan's, Daniele, I think there are people out there. I just don't think that those people are watching TV. And I think that the next the next step in media is going to be, and we're already almost there, where everybody's watching YouTube on their TV, and they're watching YouTube on their tablet, and they're watching, you know, Netflix and stuff, and you basically choose what you want, and you kind of have more control, and you basically don't need to watch CNN or whatnot. You can do your own research, you can kind of bypass that. I think of most people who listen to, you know, Bill O'Reilly or Piers Morgan, I think most people watch those type of shows, or MSNBC, they do it because they want to hear somebody that backs their opinion. They're just listening. I mean, and it's one of those things where I think a lot of people don't expand their perspectives, because most of the time you're watching or listening to somebody who agrees with you. And like you said, the good thing about having those type of debates, and that's why I love podcasts. Yours is one of the few podcasts that I think I speak for a lot of your fans, that we enjoy you storytelling and talking and without a guest just as much as we do when you do have a guest. But I think that we still need those debates and conversations with open-minded people, not the type of debates that we have on, you know, on the mainstream media, where they have somebody from the left, somebody from the right. You already know what side they're on. You already know what their talking points are, and it doesn't accomplish anything. We you know, you pick teams, and then you basically just back up that team, and then you don't actually accomplish anything. But conversation is how you progress. I mean, every great idea, every it seems like, you know, you can learn so much from bouncing ideas off each other and just listening to other people's perspectives and stuff like that. So I think that is important, and it is a little lost with cable TV, but I think that I think that's one of the reasons why podcasts has gotten popular. Don't you think that that's probably why people love your show and Rogan's and all these really popular podcasts?
Well, I'd like to take it one step farther even. It's more than just listening to things that confirm your own views, because one of the things I try to tell people, and I think it's really important, is that I'm not always right, and that you shouldn't expect me to be, and that you should be listening to a number of different sources, none of whom you expect to be right all the time. I think the weirdest thing for me is to turn on the TV and see these people who are just sure they're right about everything all the time. And to me, that's the instant, you know, you lose your credibility right there, because we're all human beings. These are all opinions, and the future's covered in fog. We're making our best judgments, hopefully not too tied to an ideology. I find that, you know, the people who are listening to my program are not people who are buying every word that I say. They want to hear opinions they don't get elsewhere, and that's what I give them. We don't tell you they're right or wrong. We tell them, you know, that these are our opinions. That's a very open-minded group of people who can listen to that, hear something that they disagree with, and continue to listen after that. I don't know how big of a percentage, a slice of the pie that is. I do think if more people were exposed to that, in the same way that working out with 5-pound weights allows you to move up to 10-pound weights eventually, I think you're exercising your brain muscle. And the more you use that, and the more you expose yourself to these different ideas, the more you're capable of exposing yourself to more different ideas, and to form judgments, and to compare and contrast different opinions. It turns you into an intelligent citizen, a person who can bring up multiple viewpoints, and a person who becomes skeptical of those who are trying to tell you exactly how it is, and trust me, because I know the truth, you know? So I would take it that step farther. I feel like we're not exercising mental muscles. And I think those who feel like they want a good mental workout search for alternatives, because the mainstream media, and listen, look, they're out, they have their purpose. I'm not slamming them for it. I'm just saying I feel like they're missing out on a large audience that they could build up even more if they would expose them to more things and develop a hunger for that stuff. You have to sort of prime the pump a little bit when it comes to this intelligent discourse. The problem is I don't think a lot of the people in the middleman positions, the program directors and all that, are that familiar with intelligent discourse themselves. I think they get a little uncomfortable with parameters that aren't as small as they're comfortable with. So, I mean, I do think that this is what podcasts and new media and all this stuff can bring to the table. It's why I'm so worried about something happening to it. I think people are very sure that this is all going to be around in the future the same way it is now. I'm not so sure, but I am a pessimist, and I'm sometimes wrong.
Yeah, well, to get to your first one, I definitely agree. I think there's something nice about somebody who's willing to admit that they're wrong. We talk about it on the show all the time that, like, not everybody we've had on I agree with, and not everybody who we've had on agrees with me. And that's, but agreeing isn't the point. The point is bouncing ideas off each other, being open-minded and willing to listen. And with that comes progression and willing, and you learn something from it. If we just pick a side and then we're just debating our sides without any willingness to listen to the other opinion or perspective, then we get nowhere. And it just, it's ignorant debating, and so I think that's really important. The other point you made, net neutrality, definitely, you know, it scares me a little bit. So, and I definitely feel like that the internet has been kind of like this anarchist place where we can just do whatever, and we have all this freedom, and it seems like it's too good to be true. Like it seems like eventually they're gonna realize, like, this is, we can't give them this much freedom. They're sharing information quickly. They can share videos quickly when something happens. You can get, you know, the real testimony from people who are at certain places when a conflict happens immediately. And it seems like I'm actually kind of surprised they haven't clamped on. I mean, I know the SOPA and a couple other things that they've tried to censor it quite a bit. But I think you're right. I think it is going to be an issue. And hopefully, do you think that the internet is just so big and it's, there's just so many people who enjoy the way it is now that it would never happen, because it'd be just, so many people would be upset that it just, they couldn't, anybody attempted that, it would be political suicide.
No, I don't think that's going to be an issue, because I think the people that are giving money to make that reality happen are the ones getting hurt. I mean, Lawrence Lessig, the Harvard law professor, wrote a great book called Republic Lost, where he points out that a lot of our elected officials don't even hear the sides of the issue that don't have a lot of money coming in, that they're not evil, that they just totally are they don't even know. They're only hearing what the money is telling them. And listen, there's some money on the pro-net neutrality side, by the way. There are big internet companies that like that. So it's not all one-sided. But look, there's always maybe going to be a weird corner of the internet for people who like the way the internet is now. But I think everybody can see that this is becoming the main distribution platform for movies, television, radio, entertainment of all kinds. And there's a huge push by the people who used to simply be able to throw money at the problem and have a hit movie, or throw money at it and have a hit record, to recreate conditions where that power exists again. And in this diffused circumstance that we have now, it's a lot harder for them to do that. And certainly there's also copyright. I mean, look at how much effort and money that Hollywood has put into even major global trade deals to protect, you know, their copyright ownership to a lot of things out there. This is all designed to create an internet that protects copyright, that allows money to talk. And will you still be able to get my podcast 10 years from now? Yeah, but it might take a long time to download. It might be very hard for me to get publicity, whereas, you know, Joe Blow on some major television network or some Comcast-owned production or whatever can debut tomorrow and have so much money thrown at the problem, it's all you hear about for 4 or 5 weeks after the debut. So I think media companies have been the big loser in the growth of the internet. They have a ton of money and control. They're buying up a lot of the backbone of the internet, and they'd like to be able to push the stuff that they make money off of and not particularly go out of their way to help the stuff that they don't make money out of. It's common sense from their point of view. I think you can see their activities apparent in a million little things involving the net. This makes perfect sense if you look at it sitting in their chair. So when people tell me we have nothing to worry about, I always try to point out, then why are all these giant corporations spending so much money on it? Or they'll say something to me like, that'll never happen, Dan. And I say, well, the people, you know, who are pretty darn intelligent and who own a lot of the internet backbone right now are spending millions upon millions of dollars based on the assumption that you're wrong. What do they know that we don't? So that's basically, you know, the way I look at it. It might be very hard for someone starting a podcast in 5, 6, 7, 8 years to ever get noticed, to ever reach a critical mass. I think that that's kind of where things are going. Does it have to go in that direction? No, the future is foggy, right? Anything can happen. But I do think that there's a major push underway to recreate certain gatekeeper functions that used to exist in the old days. Again, the internet is so diffused, it's hard to do. But listen, they don't need to have 100% total control. They'll be happy with 90%. And I haven't found anyone that says that you can't achieve that. There'll always be some weird Tor-type service or internet that most people don't know about. But the media companies don't want that. They want average Joe and the Joe Q public getting their internet, their movies, their TV, and everything from one source, only seeing what's pushed their way. And for 90% of the people, that'll probably be enough.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And you're right about politicians. I mean, most of the time, lobbyists are kind of doing the language for most of these bills anyways. They don't even look at them and or read them or whatnot. So, you know, it's definitely the truth. Well, real quick, I know you're kind of on a time restraint. So just real quick, last question. When you do your research for your history, Hardcore History podcast, obviously, like, the hard thing about doing research on a history, on any moment in history, is the fact that there's 1,000 sources and 1,000 conflicting stories. How do you pick which ones that you're going to go with, which ones you're not? And I know that you go to one country, they might have one perspective on the conflict or the story or that moment in history. And you go to another, obviously, being on counting on what side or whatnot. How do you tear that apart? How do you search through all that and break that down and know, okay, this is the version of the story I go with?
It depends on the given story. I'll give you an example. We're currently talking about the First World War on the History podcast, which is the best example I can think of demonstrating what you just talked about, because it's a huge global event, which means you're going to have sources in a lot of different countries. You're going to have a lot of different points of view. And because it was a world war, there's a bazillion things written about it. We didn't have this problem, for example, when we were talking about that obscure little, I always like to compare it to David Koresh in Waco, but it happened in the German city of Munster. I had like 3 sources for that. That becomes much, much more easily transmuted into a program. But in terms of how we decide one thing or another, we try not to over rely on anything. I mean, I think it's tempting to say, okay, this is an easier book to read, or this is a more fun way of looking at things, but you'll end up with all American sources, for example, if you stick to those kind of rules. So I do think the devil's in the detail on that. I think in my case, I'm trying to find firsthand accounts when I can from soldiers fighting on various sides. It's difficult to do because for an American, most of that information is going to be English sources. Right now, I just today in the mail received a book from a German soldier's perspective in the First World War. That's going to be invaluable for me because it's going to help me flesh out the viewpoints of this conflict from multiple angles. I'm still going to disappoint tons of people. I mean, there's going to be people, you know, people in Romania who says, you didn't cover the Romanian side of this at all, Dan, and they're going to be 1,000% right. But we do what we can. We're trying to give as multifaceted a view of a very controversial topic with a bazillion things written about it, and we just do the best we can. The main thing we want to get across, though, is the human experience in all this. I always try to put myself in the position of the people who are living through this, which is a fool's errand, obviously. I think anybody who wants to try to do that has to admit that firsthand. But if you can even give people in the listening audience a little taste of what we're talking about here, if the story's horrific enough, like World War I is, a little taste is all you need.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of getting information across. Daniele Bignelli talked about it on this show, and we talked it with him about if you can give somebody information that they can relate to or they can emotionally get attached to, then they consume it, they hold on to it. If you just tell them, you know, kind of like our problem with our educational system, why I love history now and hated history in school. If somebody just tells me a name and date and expects me to memorize it for a test, I will. But once that test is over, I don't remember it anymore. So I think that your way of getting the information across, and like you said, you make it personal. You make it you really, it seems like you can visualize a story in your head when you're telling this story, which is amazing talent on your part. And but I won't hold you up anymore. Thanks, Stan. I just want to say I really appreciate you being on. Keep up the good work. I know that you have that funny intro that too much Dan isn't good, like cigarettes and alcohol, because I know your fans are always complaining that they want more shows, but it's quality over quantity. So once that podcast is out, it's out for eternity. So I'm glad that you're making sure that you're happy with it when you release it. So just thanks again for being with us, and keep in touch, and hopefully we'll have you on again.
Well, guys, listen, one, I appreciate it. And two, I wish you the best of luck with your show. I'm glad that podcasting is doing so well. And you guys are, you're all forming the backbone of this thing that I hope is going to crystallize and solidify, so that when we look at media 10 years down the road, podcasting and independent podcasting is a strong, vibrant, important part of it. So you guys are doing yeoman's work here, and I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. Hey, enjoy the rest of your night, and keep in touch.
Just going back to work, guys. I'll do so. Take care.
Thanks, Dan. See ya.